Welcome to the weekend edition of the Daily Stoic. Each weekday, we bring you a meditation inspired by the ancient Stoics, something that can help you live up to those four Stoic virtues of courage, justice, wisdom, and temperance. And here on the weekend, we take a deeper dive into those same topics. We interview Stoic philosophers, we reflect, we prepare, we think deeply about the challenging issues of our time, and we work through this philosophy in a way that's more possible here when we're not rushing to work or to get the kids to school, when we have the time to think, to go for a walk, to sit with our journals, and to prepare for what the future will bring. The Daily Stoic is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. One of the cool things about podcasts is that you can multitask while you're listening, but depending on what you're doing right now, like for instance, if you're not in some kind of moving vehicle, there's something else you could be doing. You could be getting an auto quote from Progressive Insurance. It's easy and you could save money by doing it right from your phone. Drivers who save by switching to Progressive save nearly $700 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts, discounts for having multiple vehicles on your policy, being a homeowner, and more. So just like your favorite podcast, Progressive will be with you 24/7, 365 days a year, so you're protected no matter what. Multitask right now. Quote your car insurance at progressive.com to join over 29 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $698 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations. Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business and evolving your passions. We push what technology can do so great ideas can happen now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to now. Hey everyone, it's Ryan Holiday. Welcome to another episode of the Daily Stoic Podcast. My guest today is someone I go way, way, way back to, basically back to elementary school. We grew up in the same small town outside Sacramento, which I'll talk about. He's gone on to be an incredible author, entrepreneur, finance guru. I'm talking about Ramit Sethi. I was closer to his brother Manish growing up, also himself an entrepreneur. But Ramit is a great guy. I've actually taken some of his courses. We used Zero to Launch when we were working on Daily Stoic. My wife took his dream job course. I've read his book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. Every time he comes to Austin, we get together and have breakfast. I had breakfast with him when we both used to live in New York. Just an overall great guy, one of my favorite people to talk to. We text back and forth when we can. Just a smart guy. He always has like Tim Ferriss, he always has an interesting way of seeing things, breaking things down. You might think, given the title of his site, I Will Teach You to Be Rich, his stuff about the rich life, that there might be an Epicurean streak in Ramit that's somewhat different than the Stoics. And you know what? That may be true. But, you know, Seneca says, you want to read like a spy in the enemy camp. And that's not to say Ramit is at all the enemy, but his unique way of living, thinking about life, thinking about success, thinking about careers, thinking about money has something to teach all of us. And I think there's a lot for everyone to learn in this episode. We go a little long. We had some technical difficulties in the middle, so it cuts out. Then we had to start over. So if there's a little difference you notice, somehow, I lost not just my Wi-Fi, but my cell service at the same time in a very inopportune moment. Ramit was wonderfully patient and stuck with it. And we were able to finish the interview. Great guy. I think you'll like this. Here's my interview with Ramit. Check out his number one best-selling book, I Will Teach You to Be Rich. And of course, his many courses. Great to follow on Instagram as well. Enjoy. I was thinking as I prep for this, that we did pretty good for a couple of kids from Orangeville and Fair Oaks.
It is amazing. I mean, I think back to the modest upbringing that we both had, and then I think how we kind of learned about each other later in life, which was funny. But yeah, I look back on those times. I loved high school. Like, I had a blast. I had great friends, and also it was kind of an idyllic way to grow up. Like, it was a nice, for me, like, good friends, good family. We didn't like we weren't jetting around, but like we were good. We were happy. We had enough. We ate pizza once a month. Great.
From Mountain Mike's? Where was your pizza chain?
Well, Roundtable was a little too expensive, although I did eventually work there.
My sister did as well.
Yeah, that's right. She got me the job. So I was a pizza maker. And then one day I was promoted to oven guy. My starting wage was $4.25 an hour. Some weeks I would work like 2 or 3 hours because school came first. And, you know, I'd worked there a long time. And some days I would go in there on a Friday night. By the way, my mom had to drop me off because I couldn't drive myself yet. Some of the pizza guys would be like, "Who are you?" And I was like, "Who are you? I've been working here for years."
Right.
And, but you know, you get the check, and my checks was sometimes like $38 for the week. But like when you're a kid, that's a lot of money, you know, then that, and like being a soccer referee and all these weird things you do when you're a high school kid. And I don't know. It was very innocent when I look back on it.
I remember I was like 15 and my parents were like, "You got to get a fucking job." And I was like, "Oh, okay." And I had a job at a deli, I had a job at Wendy's. I remember I got a job hired as a cook at Wendy's, and I was promoted the first day when they realized that I spoke English to cash register. But only in retrospect, like many years later, I was like talking to my sister about all these crappy jobs I had. And she was like, "Oh yeah, mom and dad never made me get a job." And I was like, what? How did this happen? I was riding a bike to Wendy's every day in the Sacramento summer. And what were you doing?
Yeah, amazing.
But it's weird. I think you were a little bit, you're a few years older than me because I went to school with your brother. Yeah. But like Sacramento, that Sacramento is like this series of suburbs, people don't think. But like you're a child of immigrants. My mother, on my mother's side, my grandmother and my grandfather are both immigrants from Europe. You don't really think of Sacramento as being like a melting pot, like home for immigrants, but it was like a surprisingly diverse and like middle class, like what America should be kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know if everyone is like this, but there were just issues I didn't think about as a high schooler until I got to college. And then you start learning about diversity and you start learning. For example, I thought that if one kid in a family is a high achiever, then they all are, because my siblings are all high achievers. And so I go to college, and within the first week, I'm meeting tons of people from all over the country, from states I've never been to. And we start talking about our families and this and that. And I start learning that, you know, there's someone who's a high achiever, and then their sibling is not. And something may have happened, or they're just not. They just took a different path in life. And it really opened my eyes. Another thing I thought going to college was, I had this preconceived notion that if you went to private school, you were spoiled and probably a little lazy. I get to college, within 10 days, you can see people's study habits. And you find out that the correlation is basically zero. There are people who went to private schools who work harder than anybody else. There are also people who are lazy and had everything handed to them. Same for public schools. And so within 10 days, I'm discovering all these things that I just knew were true were actually not. And I think that is one of the beautiful benefits of higher education. You realize that all these things you took for granted, you thought were facts, were totally just stories that you told yourself or were fed.
Well, there's a certain shelteredness. I felt like, you know, Phil Jackson famously said that Sacramento was a bit of a cow town, and it doesn't feel like it does. So you don't quite get this. Like if you grew up in Ohio, you might go like, yeah, this is kind of, you might understand that where you're from has that sort of that Midwestern stereotype. And I didn't quite realize this. I remember you've joked how your dream course is that from zero to habanero, how to have spicy foods, which please let me be the first customer for when you do it, because like it wasn't until I went to college, like I realized like I probably didn't have guacamole until I was like 18 years old. Like not like I didn't know that it, like I don't even know if I knew it existed.
Yeah. But for me, it was sushi.
Yeah.
Didn't have it.
Yeah, so there was an interestingness to it. That your point about sort of different levels of ambition in different families is interesting. because I, both you and your brother went to Stanford, and I wonder, is that sort of the immigrant push from your family? Like my parents, like they knew that they wanted me to go to college, but it was clear that there wasn't this sense of like a certain college gets you to a certain, like there was my parents had gone to Sac State. So they were like, college is college. And one of the things I sort of learned is like, no, there's colleges and then there's like universities or something, you know, like there's different levels.
Yeah. I think with time I have gotten a different perspective than what I grew up with. I think what you just said about from the outside, there's colleges. It's very similar to anyone, for example, who wants to maybe lose weight or put on some muscle. They're like, I got to work out. And then once you start getting more experienced and perhaps even competing, you realize, oh, there's powerlifters, bodybuilders, there's this, there's like such discrete levels. When I look back on my parents, they had a series of unconscious and conscious habits that I think contributed to my siblings all being pretty successful. But I also think some of it was pure luck because there are a lot of other people who did basically the same exact things. And they just either took different routes or could, you know, had bad luck or just didn't want that same outcome, which is also fine. So some of the things I learned later looking back, and I think you only learn these looking back. When you're a kid, you're just a kid. My parents once told me in my 20s, they said, don't get a big house. I was like, why? And they couldn't get a big house because they couldn't afford it.
Sure.
But in retrospect, they said, don't get a big house because if you do, kids will go off into their own area and they won't congregate. And when you have them in the same room, that is how you build a family bond.
Huh.
I was like, whoa, that is very sophisticated. So they did that. That was more economic. My mom, you know, Indians, we love spelling bees. I love spelling bees because they are as close to a meritocracy as you can get. There's nothing genetic about it. It's work. And so my mom would, we didn't have a spelling bee in my elementary school.
Where did you go? Did you go to Leggett?
No, I went to Trajan because we had just moved from another state. So I went to Trajan and she organized the spelling bee and she would every day, this is like around sixth or seventh grade, she would quiz me. We had a book, spelling book, for like 1.5 to 2 hours a day. Now, I think if you think about today's day and age, can you imagine a parent happily spending 1.5 to 2 hours a day with a spelling book?
Right.
I think it's hard to imagine. I think a lot of us are like, well, I got this and that. She did it. She loved it. And it made me great at spelling. And it also just taught me discipline. You know, like I don't have to love every day, but after a while, they chose their heroes very carefully. And I think this is a very profound point for anyone. For people listening, you're listening to Ryan, you're listening to him talk about classics, history. You become who your heroes are. For example, if you think about Silicon Valley, there's a lot of engineers who unconsciously follow what Mark Zuckerberg does. What does he do? Number one, marketing is overrated. You should just have the best product. Two, forget about fashion. That's stupid. Even though Zuckerberg wears Brunello Cucinelli, forget that. It's just wear t-shirts and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Sure. Or Steve Jobs, same thing. Be an asshole.
Bingo.
Yeah.
And so we choose these heroes and what we don't realize is that, those attributes unconsciously seep into us. What I learned from the other side of the table is my parents chose heroes. They would celebrate teachers. Like for Indian, in the Indian culture and Eastern culture, you know, teachers are like gods,
right?
Gurus, you know, you're bowing, you're listening, anything they say, yes. And it's no surprise that I have become a teacher and that I love teachers. So yeah, those are some of the things that I think my parents unconsciously and consciously did.
Yeah, it's like, what are you learning on the spelling bee thing? Sure, of course you're learning how to spell words, but you're really learning like, if you want to get good at something, it takes hours of deliberate practice, most of which you will not get credit for, and most of which is not fun at all.
Yes, yes.
That's one of the things I love about your work. You're sort of always, especially mostly when it comes to finance, but you're sort of looking at the unconscious scripts that people have. And I think about it's like the parents don't mean them, but you can pick them up. And if you don't sort of do that work on yourself, they can, sometimes they serve you well, sometimes they don't. I remember when I was looking at colleges, like I really wanted to go to Pepperdine. So I made my parents take me to Pepperdine. Beautiful. They wanted me to look at all these much cheaper state schools. And I remember we were walking around and I was like in love with the campus. And my mom said something like, you would have to become very successful to be worth paying to go here, which was like, you know, a horrible thing to say now that I think about it. But it was like, oh, so she's picked up some idea about money and about education and about children from her parents that she's passing on to me. And you have to, I think you have to, this is why therapy is good. This is why, having a spouse that has their own assumptions is good, because you got to figure out where those scripts are helping you in your life and where they're holding you back.
I love that you brought that up, and you could unpeel what your mom said for hours.
Yes.
Right. Where did she pick that up? From her mom and dad, and from there, it's been passed down generationally. I call these invisible scripts, and we have them on an individual level and we have them on a cultural or societal level.
Yeah.
In America, we have a lot of invisible scripts. Some are good. I think some are maybe maladaptive. One of the most common ones is you should buy a house.
Yeah.
It's the best investment of all.
Sure.
And you know, I talk a lot about how that's not necessarily true. And people get really mad at me, even when I simply suggest run the numbers. And just for everybody listening, I have rented by choice for the last 15 plus years. I could buy, but I choose to rent. And this, when I tell people this, and they hear it and I can see them in front of me, they are visibly stunned because they're trying to reconcile. Wait a minute, this is, I will teach you to be a rich guy and he rents, but I thought rich people buy. So that's one. We have some really good ones in America. The idea that if you work hard, you can be successful.
Sure.
That is incredible. And also we have these general societal ones about fairness. Like if I cross the street, I know that a car is not going to come barreling by if there's a red stoplight. That turns out to be incredibly rare when you visit other countries.
Sure.
We take that for granted. So that's that. And I think if you dive into these invisible scripts, it can become fascinating. And I love what you said about having a spouse, because a spouse, or I'm guessing a child, is one of the best ways to evoke these invisible scripts.
Yeah, because your spouse is just like, what the fuck are you talking about? That is the craziest thing I have ever heard. Yeah. Like, no, we're not going to do it that way. And I think in a good marriage, it's why you actually don't want to be too similar, or ideally you come from different childhood backgrounds, because it allows you to go, like my wife will be doing something and be like, you know, we could just pay someone to do that. You know, like you don't have to do it, or you know, you can just make this decision or whatever. And then with me, she might be actually saying the exact same thing back to me, but I can't see how that script has got me trapped in a behavioral pattern that isn't serving me well.
Yeah. I've experienced the same thing. I mean, my wife and I we talked about money when we were engaged and got married. That was and has been a challenging discussion because we come from such different perspectives. One of the things that we recently took a Gottman seminar. And this was cool. So John Gottman has famously written all these books about relationships, and we loved his book, or we read one or two of them, and we decided to take a weekend seminar. So this seminar was approximately 8 hours a day, Saturday and Sunday. I mean, it was exhausting, and you're getting into these emotional discussions. And so we did it. It was very tiring, but we're so glad that we did it. And, one of the things that we really loved from the Gottman material is his point that when you have something you fundamentally disagree on with your partner, you're probably going to disagree forever. And that's okay.
Sure.
You don't have to agree on everything. Of course, you want to be values aligned and you want to be able to see eye to eye on most things, but you are probably not going to convince them to see it your way for a couple of things in life. And once you accept that, life becomes a lot easier. And so that's hard for me, because I'm like, well, I want to use my persuasion and it's so obvious. Look at the math.
But, right.
But that's not the way that relationships work. And I think getting a teacher to teach me that and show me how that works has been helpful for me, and I think helpful for us.
Yeah, I think too, it's like a lot of the sort of middle class or blue collar immigrant or like, you know, sort of self-made, a lot of that mindset serves one well up to a point, and then it becomes maladaptive very quickly. Okay. So it's this tricky thing.
Let's talk about this, because you and I, growing up where we did, we saw and grew up with that mindset. And you're right that you learn certain things that, like I said, I look back with a lot of fondness because we didn't eat out a lot. Once every 4 to 6 weeks, we took our coupons from Penny Saver that came, you know, in the mail.
And those coupon books, did you buy those?
Yeah. Right. Entertainment books, 10 bucks. Great. That was fantastic because it helped us at the level that we were at. However, once you, if and when you become more financially successful or career oriented or whatever it may be, those rules, like you said, they stop at a point. What happened for you? I'm curious. And how has that manifested as you have become, you know, successful author, live in a different place? Like, I'm curious about that.
Well, I have a bunch. One that strikes me about your work, I remember you tell this story about you're going with your family to negotiate for buying a car, and your dad's like negotiating. And I remember the exact scene because I was in it a bunch of times, probably at the Roseville Auto Mall or something. You're late at night. It's fun for 5 seconds while you're playing with the popcorn machine or, you know, running around. And then it's dragging on for hours and hours and hours. And then you talk about how your dad's like, he cancels the whole deal because they won't throw in the car mats. And I remember when I first heard that story, that struck me as a very similar thing to the kind of values that I grew up with. And that sort of millionaire next door, save your way to wealth kind of a thing. And I internalized that. And that was how I grew up. And then it was maybe like the second or third car I bought where, you thought it'd take 2 hours and now you've been there for 5 hours at a certain point, I had to go, wait, my time is worth more money than I am trying to save here. And also, this is making me unhappy. How much? And I think there was a switch where it was like, isn't the point of having money to make things like this go away if you can? And that was a breakthrough for me, for sure.
You were able to make that breakthrough. And I know many people, many of my students who have made considerable amounts of money, they still struggle with spending it consciously. In other words, they buy their time back or et cetera. What made you able to do that? Did you struggle at all with that process?
Well, I think one of the things I learned from the Stoics was this idea of memento mori, that life is short. You could leave life right now. Do you want to be pedantically haggling over small amounts of money that is not free, right? Like you are buying this thing with life, right? So there's this great Seneca line where he says, don't think about death as something in the future. Think of death as something that's happening right now. He says the time that's passed belongs to death. So like, when we would spend time as a kid doing the longer, harder thing to save small amounts of money, it was never discussed whether that was worth the other cost. Do you know what I mean? Like we would, my dad had this, we would go to Disneyland fairly often, you know, every couple of years, the whole family would reunite at Disneyland. My dad had this argument about whether, this is an example from mine. My dad was convinced, and this is before 9/11, so he's even more wrong then, more wrong now. But he was convinced you could drive to Disneyland faster than you could drive to the Sacramento airport, fly to fly and whatever. And so not only is I think that's not true, but like what my dad was unable to calculate was the immense stress that this probably caused on him, that caused on our family, all this stuff. And then two other wrinkles on it, not to give too much away about my parents, but I was talking to my wife the other day, we were talking about, I remember when we would go on road trips as a kid, my parents would take out the middle seat of our minivan so my sister and I could play on the floor while we were driving. It's not just he was saving money, but like he couldn't calculate what would happen if we all died in a fiery car crash. So I think it's like, what do you really value in life? Is it saving time? Is it saving money? Is it being safe? I remember as a kid, I was telling this to my wife too about the pandemic. We went on a vacation to Hong Kong when I was in high school. because flights and travel was very cheap during the SARS outbreak. So I was like, can you imagine us using the dangers of the pandemic to save money traveling? I mean, that's insane. I value my family more than saving money on a vacation. But you can pick up these scripts to go to our point.
This is, yeah, I love these examples. I'll never forget, you know, oh, that looks like a good deal on hotels.com. We better get that one right now.
Right. Even though you don't actually want to go there. It was almost like the deal was worth more than anything.
That's exactly it. There's a author, Marshall Goldsmith, who's written some great books. And one of the things he talks about is the need to be you. And this is what happens when you become successful to a point and you plateau. And he works with smart people. Why can't they make it to the next level? And it's the excessive need to be you. So that might happen with people who say stuff like, well, I just tell it how it is. Well, okay, that may work when you're on the playground and you're telling some jokes, but at work, you need to change if you want to make it to senior management.
Sure.
The excessive need to be you can also come when you are using the same scripts that were functional when you had a family and not a lot of money versus now when you are more comfortable and maybe you care about risk a little bit more. I find that it's almost a point of pride sometimes for people to not care. They want to continue to live that script. Like, I don't care. Like, yeah, I can go in economy, no problem. Which is fine if that is what you truly want. If you look and say, you know what? I have X dollars and I would rather spend it on a beautiful dinner when we get to our destination. God bless, please. But more often than not, I find that there's no calculus happening, no calculation. And sometimes it's this interesting and almost perverse script of like, I don't care. I don't need that. I don't want to be the kind of person who has to fly in that seat. And that is when you're really starting to confront identity. I remember one of my students who grew a multiple six-figure business. And we were talking, I was helping her out and she lived in the Midwest and she was telling me how she hates grocery shopping, hates it. I was like, why don't you just pay someone to do it for you? And this is years ago before there was Postmates, et cetera. And she looked at me like I was nuts. She said, like, why would I do that? I can just shop for myself. And that is the point. Yes, you can. But at a point, your financial means have already changed. That happened long ago. It's your identity that hasn't yet changed. And it's up to you if you want to change that identity or not.
That's an interesting, that excessive need to be you, I think explains a lot of the trouble people are having with the pandemic. Like, you know, you'll talk to people and again, obviously I think it's, you got to sort of stipulate or exclude people who don't have a choice about these things, right? Who are struggling, who don't have access to certain technologies, whatever it is. But you talk to people, let's say in our peer group who are successful, have businesses, their time is worth a lot of money. And you'll go, or that family, people depend on them, and you go, so, you know, what are you doing during the pandemic? Have you been socially distancing? You've been safe? They go, oh yeah, we haven't seen anyone. And they go, I mean, I do go to the grocery store a couple times a week or whatever. And you're like, why were you going to the grocery store a couple of times a week, not during a pandemic, when there was no health risk? Like, you know, you can not do that, right? And it's clear that it's just a habit. And questioning that habit is hard to do. And I think people who are handy, people who like doing stuff for themselves, it can be hard for them to question. It's not whether you can do it or not. It's whether you're the best person to do it or not. And to be able to delegate does not say anything about you, except that you are prioritizing something other than that thing.
I completely agree. One thing I would say is that it's natural, just like if you have a bike, you need to oil the chain every so often and do some maintenance. It's normal that your identity will need to be polished or re-examined regularly.
Sure.
So I would recommend, you know, once a year, once every 6 months to 12 months, you take a look at your calendar and you say, okay, I see my calendar right now. Great. I'm going to put that aside and then blank calendar. what do I want it to be? Now, again, of course, I'm speaking to people who have some semblance of control over your calendar. If you can't change your 9-to-5 job calendar, fine, I'm not talking about that. What happens before and after work? What happens on Saturday and Sunday? And I recommend the blank page one because I tried for about a year and a half to take my calendar and rework it meeting by meeting. And I discovered that there was incredible pushback for me to change even one meeting. So I would say, guys, you know, I'm not sure I need to be in this meeting or should I add this? And nobody wants change. So I couldn't do it. And I'm the CEO of my own business.
Sure.
So after a year and a half, I said, you know what? Blank page. What should I be going to? And that transformed everything for me. But I would just encourage people, your identity is, we have seasons in life. And we've been talking a lot about this. There are seasons with money. There are seasons with careers. With money, you know, when I was in my 20s, I was very growth oriented. I'm willing to spend 70, 80 hours a week. And I'm investing heavily. Great. In my 30s, I was a little bit more settled. I wanted to spend more. I started to spend on things that I loved. But I retained some of the stuff I didn't care about. I still drive my car from 2005. Until last year, I had my laptop from 8 years ago. I ran my business off of it. Like, don't care about that stuff.
Sure.
But love clothes, love travel, et cetera. This is the IWT concept of spend extravagantly on the things you love as long as you cut costs mercilessly on the things you don't. We know also from financial literature that typically people accumulate as much as they can in their 30s. In their 40s, they have a kid and typically a mortgage. It's in their 50s when they start thinking about retirement. And this is often pretty late in life. So right. If you can start a little earlier, you get a massive edge. That's why I wrote my book. What I would say is acknowledge the seasons. I think one of the most humbling things is to acknowledge, you know what? I'm pretty much 98% the same as everybody else. I have the same productivity challenges, fitness challenges, food, et cetera. Let me do the basic stuff I need to do to optimize my food, my fitness, my money, et cetera. And then for that special 2% where I'm unique, where I'm different, I can go crazy. I can try all kinds of risky stuff or things that I love that nobody else gets. But I also need to acknowledge that these are the seasons in life. Like right now, I don't meditate. It's just not my thing. But I know that later in life, I probably will.
Sure.
So that's what I would say. What do you think about that?
No, I think the seasons of life is a good thing. I remember I talked to our friend Tim Ferriss not long ago, and he was talking about experiments, which is another way of saying it. And it's something that's been freeing for me where it's like, okay, like let's say there's some like household chore that I'm going to pay someone to do. You know, we were doing the maintenance on our pool ourselves. And then it felt crazy to, you know, you do the math, you're like, oh, I'm paying someone $200 a month to come clean the pool. That adds up really quickly. And so like, if you flesh that out, the lifetime of where you live, that can be very high. But if you say, I'm busy with work right now, and what's important to me is, say, finishing my book. It's more important that I have an extra 20 minutes with my kids every day, or so on and so forth, that I'm going to decide for now to do this, right? Even like if you have a business and you want to hire an employee, you don't go, what does this do to the margins of my business forever? This isn't a lifetime contract. The idea of like, I'm going to try this for now has been freeing for me because then I'm not extrapolating out, you know, what this is going to be forever.
That's interesting. That's actually the opposite of what a lot of people in the beginning stages of personal finance do. They go, wait, this computer is $1,000. If I multiply out how much I could get compounded, that's like $25,000. Oh my right. God, is it worth it? And I think that's helpful. I used to do that with quarters because it was how many quarters of laundry is this worth to me back when I was in college. Sure. At a certain point, I stopped doing that. And this is what has been very freeing for me. Below a certain price point, I don't want to spend more than 2 seconds on it. So this old, oh, you shouldn't buy lattes, forget that advice. Lattes are not going to save you. And honestly, most people need to stop asking $3 questions and they need to start asking $30,000 questions. So forget about the lattes, buy all the lattes you want. Spend more time on things like, what's my asset allocation? Have I automated my investments? Am I healthy?
Right,
sure. How many hours a night am I sleeping? Let's get that right. And let's stop worrying about, can I order an extra appetizer? When I moved my level of focus, almost like my eye gaze went from $3 up a little bit, suddenly life became more fun. And it also started to move the needle in a much more positive way than being stuck at that $3 level.
I've talked a lot about my morning routine here. One of the things I do every morning after I get up is I take a bunch of vitamins that my doctor recommended after some blood tests. I take a vitamin C, a zinc, a omega-3, and I take a couple others who I'm forgetting, but I definitely know whose vitamins I take. And they actually happen to be today's sponsor, and I've been taking them long before Thorne sponsored today's episode. Thorne takes a personalized, innovative, and scientific approach to health and wellness with all their supplements, and they've teamed up with leading medical professionals to bring out highly effective nutritional supplements. Because I'm a runner, I'm always trying to take care of my joints. And with Thorne, I never have to question what's in each supplement. Give your body what it really needs with Thorne. Go to thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your first order. That's thorne.fit/dailystoic and use code dailystoic for 10% off your order. thorne.fit/dailystoic. Use code dailystoic. And note, these statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. There's a lot of things we know would be good for us. Problem is, we don't have time. It's just tougher. I think therapy is like that. We all know that sitting down, talking to someone, really working on our issues will make a difference. So the problem is finding a therapist, driving across town, all of that, right? And that's where Talkspace comes in, today's sponsor. Because by doing everything online, Talkspace has made getting the help you want easier, more accessible, and more affordable. With Talkspace, you can sign up online and get a personalized match with a provider that's right for you, typically within 48 hours. You can have virtual sessions with your licensed therapist from the comfort of your home. And Talkspace is secure and private, using the latest end-to-end grade encryption to store client information and complying with the latest HIPAA regulations. As a listener of this podcast, you'll get $80 off your first month with Talkspace when you go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter code SPACE80. To match with a licensed therapist today, go to Talkspace.com/stoic and enter promo code SPACE80, that's 80, to get $80 off your first month and show your support for the show. That's Talkspace.com/stoic, promo code SPACE80.
Well, that's sort of the Ben Franklin thing about penny wise, pound foolish. But one of the things you talk about that I think ties interest, it's sort of a timeless philosophical question, you know, so the good life, you know, you talk about the rich life. I saw you tweet the other day, something I loved, where you're like, for me, the rich life is never stepping foot in Home Depot ever again, which I love. Is it's like, what do you want to be doing? What do you like? What is hell to you? And how do you make sure that you make choices that as much as possible avoid that? Like, if you had to go to Home Depot to save your family, of course you'd go to Home Depot, right? Or if suddenly, you know, your business disappeared and Home Depot is the only place that hired you, you get a job there in 2 seconds. But if you have the Stoics talk about this idea of preferred indifference, that not E-N-C-E, but T-S, indifference. Like, so Seneca says, you know, it's better to be tall than short, probably. Better to be rich than poor, probably. So it has nothing to do with like whether you're a good person or not. But if you had a choice, which one would you choose? And the idea that being philosophical or wise or smart means that you don't choose the obviously better thing if you can is silly. It's like, of course a philosopher could be rich, right? Of course a philosopher could be famous. Like, why would you turn down things as long as they don't change you, if you have the means to enjoy them? So I think this idea of what is your rich life, to me, is like one of the most essential questions a person can ask themselves.
I agree. It's a very fraught question too, especially in this culture, because first of all, the word rich implies lots of things. In fact, the idea that money, listen to how people say this, money changes you. Money changes you. I'm so disgusted when I say that. That's how people say it. Well, let me tell you, money does change you, and it should. It has allowed me to dream bigger and take adventures I never would have, to be more generous.
Money is optionality. So of course it should change you because you now have more options.
Correct. One of the things that I see on Twitter a lot is somebody starts their tweet by saying, if I had $1 million, I would never, and I just close the tweet. I'm like, I have no interest in what you think you would do because you have no idea until you are there. This is the, when I talk about my money dials, I have 10 money rules. And some of my rules, when I say money rules, a lot of people, the first thing they do when I challenge them to make their own money rules, they all do the same thing. The first time they create their money rules, it's all restriction. No spending on this, only buy generics, no need to get that.
Right.
Okay, fine. That's the sort of the puritanical view that America has on money. It's all about no. I have a series of rules that are meaningful for me. Some of them are, you could say, restrictive, but some of them are also really permissive. One of them is business class on flights over 4 hours. Okay, now that is, okay, I can financially afford it, but it also says to me that I don't need to fly business class if I'm just going on an hour-long flight. I don't need it.
Sure.
But longer than that, that's powerful. Another one is to always have 1 year of emergency fund cash. That's sort of, okay, that's nice. It's a little bit more than most recommend, fine. But then they start to become very personal. They fit me like a glove. These are my money rules. I said, never question spending money on books, appetizers, health, or donating to a friend's charity fundraiser. Now, why?
I like the last one. That's interesting.
Yeah, I'll tell you why each of those. Why am I talking about appetizers when I'm talking about business class flights? One of them is $10. One of them is maybe thousands. Why are these even in the same universe? Well, the answer is these are my rules, not yours.
Sure.
And if you knew me growing up, we never ordered appetizers. We couldn't afford it. So to me, to be able to go to a restaurant and say, ooh, that looks good. Should I get that? Oh, that looks good too. Get them both. $20, but incredibly meaningful to me. And the fundraiser one, I think, starts to get into some of the relational ones on the list. There's that one. And there's also marry the right person, which is a money rule. And earn enough to work only with people I respect and like. So these are all about people. The money part, at a certain point, you solved it. You won the game. Now it becomes meaning and people. The charity fundraiser, my wife and I ran a fundraiser a couple of years ago. And we hosted it in New York. And it was regarding children being separated at the border. And I wrote a big post on it, on what we learned and how much we generated for the organization. One of the things I learned was that the psychology of giving is totally different than the psychology of buying. I had multiple people, one of my readers, who spent approximately $15,000 with I Will Teach You to Be Rich. He wrote in because we had 5 scholarship tickets available for our event. He's like, I'd like to apply for that. I was like, you've spent $15,000. Why? He goes, well, I don't, this is a $100 ticket, by the way. He goes, yeah, but like, I don't really, it's not in my charity budget. And because I have zero shame about raising money for an organization, I was like, listen, not only are you going to buy one ticket, you're going to buy 5 tickets. So pay those tickets. Otherwise, don't write me again.
Right.
And it was offensive to me that someone who can obviously afford a tremendous amount is trying to take a free ticket from someone else. But I learned, because this happened multiple times, that the psychology of giving is different than the psychology of buying. So what we learned and why I added this to my money rule is if one of my friends ever runs a fundraiser, like a 5K, not only I'm going to give, I'm going to give more than they ask, and I'm going to try to be the first one to give. Because if some of my friends gave me $150, I will never forget it. It right. meant so much because you feel so insecure when you're raising money and, sure. oh, is anyone going to support me? For somebody to even give anything was awesome. $5, I love you. I appreciate it. But to give the full ask or even more, it was like, I mean, it was an incredible feeling. And so that's why I added it to my money rule.
I'm so glad you brought that up because it's something I've sort of been working on in my life. And I'd be curious how it connects with you because of the money scripts that I got as a kid, I don't know if I got any negative ones about giving, but I didn't get any about generosity or charity or giving. And so as I've become successful and as I've sort of figured out what's important to me, I've decided that that's something that's meaningful and important to me, but I realize I don't really have any of the skill set or the experience. Like, you know, maybe you let's say you grew up Mormon, and so you grew up tithing a certain percentage of your income. That would be a script you would have that you'd be quite familiar with. And so that sort of charity and giving, like we just did a raise for Feed America, where like I put in 10 and I thought maybe we'd double it. And people, we've raised like 110, which is a million plus meals. But it's like the feelings that evokes in me are very unfamiliar. Like being around generosity, watching generosity, being a part of it. It's a very emotional, surprising thing because I don't have a script about it.
Well, man, I'm really happy to hear that. I think you and I should talk more about how we can give and how we can build our philosophy around it. I'm really glad you bring up the fact about giving back. Maybe we should work on that together because I'm building my own philosophy around philanthropy and charity. You know, growing up, I think middle class, it's no surprise that we didn't receive messages of philanthropy. That's very much an upper class thing. The way that we were taught was, you know, we would go and do seva, which is service at our temple. We would serve food and things like that. But it was not we were not attending galas and writing checks. That was not happening. One of the things the reasons that I have been public about giving, we did Feeding America, ACLU. I wrote a $101,000 check to provide free transportation for voters on election day. And the extra 1,000 is because Indians always add an extra one.
Ah.
So what I really want to do there, it's not just the money. It is inspiring an audience of young people to realize you can give. You don't have to wait till you're 70. You don't have to take that Silicon Valley invisible script. This is what every single person in Silicon Valley says. Oh, I'd really love to give, but I just don't know where it's going. So I need to build a spreadsheet and make sure I optimize for all the variables so that I can track it and trace it. Why don't you shut the fuck up and write a check? Okay. And you can track it as well, but you don't have to wait till you're 70. What they are really saying when they say that, these are rich people. We both know them. You can write a $10,000 check. You could find it in the cushions of your couch. I know how much money you have. And you can also find organizations, or you can found one yourself, that will provide accountability. But guess what? There are greater things in life than accountability. This is a key invisible script that pervades in America, this idea of responsibility and accountability. We have people talking about, oh, the government doesn't spend correctly. Yeah, okay, we should increase efficiency. I agree. Those same people can't manage their budget of $50,000. And they're sitting here preaching accountability and responsibility for a multi-trillion dollar economy. No, thank you. Write the check and work on improving accountability over time.
Well, I think it's a way, it's like you can always find a reason to not do something. So you can let perfect be the enemy of good. You can let, you can create these scripts about I'm waiting, or you can create this and or even like I'm interested in effective altruism and GiveWell is sponsored the podcast. I think it's really interesting, but it's like you can also, there's also, that's also a way to sort of intellectualize and almost make the problem distant. And I think the effective altruism thing is really interesting if done hand in glove with what are your obligations here where you live in the community that you belong to, that in both of our cases has done very well for you. You know what I mean? That's like that. And you and I have both taken some heat for some political stances we've taken over the last year. The interesting thing I've seen about some of I get the sort of white working class anger, the left behind anger from certain Trump supporters. What I have more trouble understanding or tolerating is people who the system worked for as well as the system could possibly work for being angry and wanting to punish other people lower down the chain It's a weird mentality, but I feel like there's a great line from Bill Campbell, if you've read that book, Trillion Dollar Coach, which is incredible.
Yeah, it's a great book.
But he says, if you've been blessed, be a blessing. And I've been trying to sort of build that into my life in all sorts of ways.
I appreciate you, man. I appreciate you saying it and being public about it. I just read your post yesterday, that your new one that you made. And I want to show people that you can be successful. You can be accountable in your business. You can be profit oriented, all of which I am. I have metrics. I have amazing team members. We want to generate profits. We sell amazing products to customers. And I also am happy to give.
Yes.
You can do both. I believe in personal responsibility. I worked hard. I studied spelling bee books for hours and hours on end. But I also believe that there are systemic issues that hold all of us back, and especially certain groups. You can hold both of those beliefs at the same time. I believe in personal responsibility. I also believe in tackling systemic change. And when I say that, especially as someone in the personal finance world, personal finance is very heavy on personal responsibility. Listen, I love it. What do you think I've been talking about for the last 16 years? Start an IRA, fill up your 401k. Everybody can save $20 a month. That's personal responsibility. But I also know that if I was not born in America with two educated parents who pushed me, I'm not sitting here talking to you, and I'm not taking a 6-week vacation. So we need to acknowledge both of those things.
Well, I think there's the operative word in the phrase that you said, and I think people miss this, is that it's personal responsibility. So the Stoics, Marcus Aurelius says this great line. He says, strict with yourself, tolerant with others. So it's like, I hold myself to incredibly high standards, and I hold myself personally accountable. I don't give myself much slack, et cetera. But it's... that has to be balanced out by an understanding that other people are struggling with things that I didn't struggle with. They had, you know, knocks against them that I didn't have, so on and so forth. And they're not a contradiction. It's like you can hold yourself to a strong set of rules, and then you give a lot of people space and time and help so they can get to a place where they have the luxury of being as strict with themselves as you and I are.
It doesn't take anything away from you to
Definitely not to
give to others and even to give empathy. I will also say that at some point in life, all of us will struggle with something. And everyone listening, even people who are extremely on the side of personal responsibility, for those people listening, listen up. You are struggling, all of us are struggling with something in life that we know we should do, but for whatever reason, we haven't been able to do it. For a lot of people, it has to do with food, fitness, weight. For a lot of people, it has to do with money. Oh, I know I should set up an investment account. I know I should save more. I got this debt. Over time, I have become much more compassionate. In my early 20s, I was judgmental with myself, and I was super judgmental with everyone else. I was like, why don't you just open up a Roth IRA? It's so obvious. Look at the math. Now I understand that to even talk about words like Roth IRA, it includes such a level of complexity. And maybe their parents lost their house in the 2008 recession. There are lots of generational things going on.
Or maybe they grew up in a family that didn't even have access to banking. You know what I mean? Like, it's so easy to assume this stuff. And there's that expression where it's like, if you're not liberal when you're young and you have no heart, and if you're not conservative when you're older, you have no brain. I hate that expression so much. One, I mean, I grew up in a conservative household. Sacramento was a surprisingly conservative town. But I hate the idea. Let's put aside the policy beliefs, because I think there's a lot. Different people can have different policy beliefs from totally different. I hate the idea that your heart should be hardening as you go. That's the exact wrong way to go through life. The more you experience, the more you live, the more people you meet, it should be increasing your compassion and your sense of community, not the opposite. Because if that's not true, then your life is getting shittier as you go. You're becoming more curmudgeonly and angry and selfish and isolated. Like, what kind of success is that?
Everybody listen to what Ryan just said. Just think about the two possibilities for your life as you become more successful. In option one, you become increasingly judgmental. You look down on others who didn't make it to the same level. You judge them, you punish them, you become punitive towards them, and you end up in your life with a relatively large bank account, and every day you wake up and you are outraged. How could they do this? They're coming to take away X, Y, or Z from me. And that is the logical end conclusion of your life in option one. Option two, you acknowledge, hey, I worked hard. I feel that I was justly rewarded. But I also acknowledge, you know what? I was lucky. And man, if that person hadn't called me in for that interview because I know this person, that might not have happened. You know what? I am grateful that I grew up in a country where, as I've made more money, this marauding gang didn't kick down my door and demand 30% of every dollar. I'm grateful that electricity and water turns on when I turn the faucet. And you know what? I can afford to be generous financially. I can afford to write a $500 check or a $1,000 check. And I can also afford to empathize, because there's a couple things in my life that I still struggle with. And yeah, I know I should be able to do it right, but it's just hard for me. And now that I realize it's hard for me, oh my God, it must be really hard for someone else who's taking care of an ailing parent or just never grew up learning this kind of stuff. So I'm going to be generous. Which do you want to be?
Totally.
You have a choice. You create your life. You choose.
And you may have to go. So if you do, tell me. But the one last thing I wanted to talk to you about, because I love that so much, is you and I have both, because of some of the stands we've taken and things we've talked about, and because of the niches we're in, sort of me in stoicism, you in finance, there's been a bit of a backlash from it. And you've talked over the years about your platform, how you respond to emails, haters, and such. One of the things I keep trying to explain to people, it's not what I don't need to convince you of what I think. If you don't like it, that's fine. But what I do think is important is your impulse to tell me that I shouldn't be saying it, because you've totally misunderstood why I do what I do, right? I've taken to replying. Sometimes I just, if I'm feeling really snarky, I'll just be like, okay, Karen. And that's all that I say. But if I really am going to take the time to explain it, I go, look, I did not become a writer to not say what I think. This is my job. My job is not to tell you what you want to hear. My job is to say what I think. And that to me, that's our obligation as human beings. Whether you're a politician, whether you're a writer, an accountant, an athlete, your job is to do what you think is the right thing to do. It's so interesting to me that we have this impulse now as a society to try to crush that in people instead of saying, well, I'm going to reply with what I think. Do you know what I mean? It's weird.
Yes. I love this topic. I have all the time in the world to talk about this. Okay. Let's just get that straight. I love this. So how do your readers react when you tell them that? That's a very powerful point. How do they react to that?
Usually there's no reply at all, but I think it's well, why'd you have to be political about it? Right. There's this interesting thing where it's like, if someone disagrees with you, it's political, what I love about Stoicism is it's like, look, they go like, what would Seneca think about you getting political? And it's like, oh, you mean Seneca, the professional politician? I think he would be okay with it. Do you know what? Life is politics. You know, the idea that you can talk about money and it not be political is preposterous. Money is what makes the world go round. Therefore, it is political. So there's this interesting thing where when we disagree with someone, we say you're getting political. When we agree with them, of course, we have no objections to it.
That's right on. The psychology of this is what fascinates me. And last time we talked about trolls and haters, and it's not just that I love engaging with them, which I do. It's that I love the psychology of being able to actually talk to someone who writes me an email. And the first thing they say to me after reading for 9 years is, fuck you. Right? I'm like, what's wrong? Are you having a bad day? Come on, I have a recommended, I can give you some hair cream if you're having a bad hair day. Let's talk. And it completely opens up a conversation.
Yeah.
I rarely convince them, but like you, I actually have metrics on what happens. You know, half of them don't reply. 25% say, oh my God, I didn't think anyone would actually read this, which raises the question.
That's why a are big you one. People think sometimes the person they're yelling at is not a real person. And they think that it's just a cathartic, like vomiting of aggression and meanness that they don't think is going to land on anyone or anything. But of course it does.
I find that one to be actually the most haunting of all. Yes. Because you're having a tantrum as a child would, screaming into the ether. Mm-hmm. And when I respond to them or others respond, they're startled. And of course, it rarely causes them to reconsider their overall worldview. You know, maybe I shouldn't have childlike tantrums. But anyway, the psychology I think is fascinating. And I have, for the last 10 years or so, I've been cataloging these. I have filters, sub-filters on types of responses people give. One of the things that I love when they say, Ramit, I'm disappointed in you. And I think to myself, okay, hold on a second. First of all, the only people who get to be disappointed in me are my parents, and I get to be disappointed in my future children. But I don't think you get to be disappointed in me. What are we talking about here? What is the relationship going on?
Right.
And in the past, they were disappointed because, you know, I gave away 98% of my material for free and I decided to charge for some of my programs. They're disappointed in that. Again, what is happening here is they are seeing this relationship be redefined and they don't like it. And so they're writing this thing as if it's going to change me. The other thing that I've learned is that people believe that if they are following someone, they have to agree with everything they say. And if they don't agree, you know, it's one thing if the person wears a shirt they don't like. Most people can overlook that. It's no problem. But when it becomes salient, like, I don't eat this. Or, as I recently said, if I live a good life, I'm never walking in Home Depot again. Well, guess what? Some Home Depot lovers got really mad. You can see the comment. They are pissed. I don't like home repair. I don't want it. It's okay. So they take it personally. Now, when it comes to the people they follow, politics becomes the most salient of all. And suddenly they're like, I agree with 98% of what this person says, but he said this thing about politics. I'm disappointed. And to me, that just represents a lack of discernment. I follow a lot of people who I don't agree with on certain things. That's okay. If I actually disagree with them on values, then I'm going to unfollow them. Fine.
Audible is the destination for thrilling audio entertainment with highly anticipated new releases and next listen recommendations to habituate every type of thriller listener. The time is now more than ever to embrace breathtaking, sinister, and shocking tales that have enthralled you, especially with brand new exclusive thrillers from best-selling authors who are guaranteed to keep you gripped. My wife and I have both been raving about this book, Furious Hours, which is this true crime story that lo and behold, involves Harper Lee. And then even though I've been raving about the book for years and years, my wife finally listened to it on Audible. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from the entire catalog, including the latest bestsellers and new releases. Visit audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. That's audible.com/dailystoic or text dailystoic to 500-500. The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. I talk about that in Growth Hacker Marketing. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. And now through April 15th, NetSuite is offering a one-of-a-kind flexible financing program. Head to netsuite.com/stoic right now. netsuite.com/stoic.
I think an interesting part about it too, and I think this is an important, this is where I think it becomes a lesson, even if you don't have a platform, is that almost all of the disappointed, I hate you, unfollow, you just blew up your business, it's actually a lie and it's an intimidation tactic that's not true. So like, just to peel back the curtain, when I see like people say toxic political stuff, because I've posted over the years, on Instagram, you can flag the account so they can continue to comment, but they don't know that their comments aren't showing up unless you approve it, right? So I kind of see these as like infected people. And what's fascinating to me is that they'll say this nasty, horrible stuff on one post. I unfollow, I hate you. And then I watched, they continue to comment. So it wasn't true. It was really just a bullying tactic that they hoped would work that didn't work. And you kind of realize that it's like, oh, so there's all these things you're not supposed to do or say. You're not supposed to be true to yourself. You're not supposed to be your true self. Or there's be all these consequences. But the consequences are illusionary. And sometimes you have to sort of pierce through that a couple times to realize, oh, there actually isn't anything to be afraid of. I'm going to say what I think.
Funny that you do that. I do the same thing. I see them because they're restricted and they're grayed out on Instagram.
Yeah.
And whenever I see a restricted comment come up, I notice that it is inevitably toxic.
Right.
And it what that tells me is the following. Number one, if you're a creator, of course you should listen to what the market is telling you. Of course you should listen. And there are times where you're going to say something that is insensitive or inappropriate and you should take action and acknowledge that.
Sure.
I've done that. Three times in my career for things I said that were wrong. And people told me that, and it was a very quick response. And I said, you know what? That was a mistake. But you should also be able to discern when it is a bullying tactic. And what I've learned is that it's, as long as you have a good values orientation, it's rarely about the creator. It is about that person.
Yeah.
And that sound, you know, we've all heard people say that, you know, hurt people hurt others and all that stuff. But when you dig into the psychology, which is why I love chatting with them, you realize, whoa, there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. And I think it was helpful to me to realize like, oh, because Marcus Aurelius talks about this. He says, you know, there's infected, you can get infected with the plague. And he was saying this during the real plague. But there's also a different kind of plague that infects your character. And I think you're watching people who have, you know, whether they got COVID-19 or not, they've been infected by something in a way worse because it's chosen. And to me, that's like callousness and cruelty and conspiracy theories. And like life's just too short to be that kind of person. It's definitely too short to have those kind of people in your life.
Have you stopped being friends with anyone who, for example, supports Trump or you disagree with on very salient political issues?
It's interesting too, because I get this reputation I'm some like insane liberal. It's like I would happily vote for a Republican. I think I voted for Republicans before. It's been a weird period of a couple years here, but I've definitely voted. I definitely know Republicans. I definitely have advised and worked with Republicans. I mean, there's a number of sittings Republican senators that read my books and who I've gotten to know, and I cherish those relationships. I mean, Ben Sasse blurbed my last book. So I would never go like, oh, because you voted for Trump, you're dead to me or something. That's not at all. But I your point you made earlier, I think, is a good way to distinguish it. I would never get rid of someone from my life because I disagree with them. If someone has changed their values and is living by values that I find to be abhorrent or, you know, toxic or negative, that would be something that I would change. So I think I've definitely seen some people over the last several months who it's like, oh, I'm going to definitely spend a lot less time with this person and they're going to have a much smaller role in my life given who they've revealed themselves to be with their choices and beliefs. What about you?
I find it to be one of the most challenging things that I have thought about in the last 4 years. It is really hard. And I have ended relationships because of politics. And I talked about it with friends and people who I go to for advice. And I talked about it for a long time, like over a year. It's one thing if someone comes out blatantly and says something super offensive, for example, about immigrants. That's easy. That's sure. An easy goodbye. It's a lot harder if it's more subtle. And if it's the type of media that's brought up is, for example, you know, the Heritage Foundation, and every talking point, like the frequent talking points I receive in Instagram DMs. When I tell people, I did a whole segment on how raising taxes on millionaires overall does not cause the mass state migration that people think it does. And I showed them the data and the books and all that stuff. And, you know, to this day, I get people, I got a guy who makes $20 an hour in Florida telling me that they should not raise taxes on the rich. I said, listen, my friend, they don't want your money. They want mine, and right. they should have it. I can afford it.
Sure.
And so the response to that is typically these right-wing talking points and tropes that I've heard a million times. And with each one that I, you know, I engage and I show them some data and all that. And at the end of the day, the conclusion is simply, I don't want to pay more in taxes. I don't find that to be intellectually rigorous. I don't find it to be morally upstanding. I don't find it to be relevant, since our friend is making $20 an hour in Florida.
Sure.
And that is a little harder, because it's subtle. And yet you know that the value system is aligned with certain things when you trot out these certain talking points. So I find that difficult.
Yeah, I've been trying to repeat to myself, it's probably somewhat of a Stoic idea. It's just like, they're good people who believe a bad thing, or they're good people who have done a bad thing. And that's like, I think that's a more conciliatory belief than they are bad people and I'm writing them off. But it is hard as you watch one bad thing lead to another bad thing to another bad thing. And I think if you have a strong sense of, what's fascinating to me is, it's like, people will listen. I've written 10 books of historical stories and about, you know, advice on how to live your life. And people are like, oh, you know what you're talking about. Please tell us more. And then if that veers slightly, if I write a story about, you know, 2000 years ago, they love my analysis. But if I dare to analyze what's happening in 2020, I have no idea what the fuck I'm talking about. And so it's hard, if you are a student of history, if you do really know what you're talking about, not to see how related these things are and what the implications of them are. So it's a tricky thing.
One of the reasons that I have been so fascinated and so troubled by what is happening is, when I was at Stanford, I studied cults, coercion, lying, deception. And, you know, there are some very foundational elements. We have cognitive dissonance by Fessinger and bystander effect research. You would think that people are so logical that if they were sitting in a room and it started filling with smoke, well, of course, people are going to get up and leave. Wrong. We can experimentally cause them to stay sitting in the room by leaving other people around them who are just casually having a coffee.
Right.
And you can actually cause people to do things that are not only against their own self-interest, but can result in their own death. Well, guess what? We're seeing precisely that happening today. And I think back to some of the foundational cult research that was done. There was a group of people who believed that aliens were going to land, and they had a date. To their credit, they actually had a specific date. Well, the first time, of course, the aliens didn't come. And so they said, oh no, that was just a practice round. Okay, great. So this social psychologist infiltrated, because he knew he was going to be able to see what happens at the moment that reality detaches from their beliefs. Second time, they don't come again. Somebody starts crying in the room. The clock ticks midnight. And then what they did was, they switched their cognition and they said, these aliens spared us because we are believers. And so what this social psychologist, Leon Fessinger, realized was, there are criteria to define what happens in a quote cult. And one of those is, you need to have social support. You cannot withstand the forces of quote reality on your own. And that is why I find what's happening today so troubling. It's one thing if you believe that the election didn't happen, that Biden didn't win. Okay, you can believe that, but now you have tens of millions of others who believe that and are actively supporting you on social media. In my opinion, it is almost impossible to disentangle that. If that's one of your family members, maybe with a prohibitively large amount of time and money, you could. However, it's unlikely. And this is why I'm so fascinated and troubled by what I see going on. It's, you know, at the beginning, you think, oh, that's funny. You know, certain people believe certain things. But just as you said, Ryan, when you start to see where the path leads to people not believing in viruses, in people not believing in masks, in people not believing that an election actually happened, suddenly you realize this isn't a joke. And it's actually causing life or death decisions. And that, from a psychological perspective, is extremely troubling.
It's also interesting to me, the number of people that you and I both know that have large platforms that you could have this conversation with privately, but don't want to say anything. Like, I was talking to Tom Bilyeu, who's great. And he was saying, he's like, look, I don't like to be political because that's not what my audience is interested in. And he's like, but what really made me start talking about this stuff was the realization that I wasn't saying it, not wanting to hurt the audience. And it's alarming how many people I know who are otherwise smart, courageous, civically minded people who are sort of conspicuously silent about things because they think it would be bad for their email list. And it is bad for your email list. I can tell you.
It is. I can tell you that myself too. That's really funny you say that. On Instagram, whenever I post, it's like people leave. And I'm okay with that. I will say there is a foundational article called Who Goes Nazi?
Oh.
And it is, first of all, before anyone listening says, oh my God, Ramit is comparing X to Y, just read the article. It's a canonical article. And it talks about the type of people who, in this writer's view, would go Nazi. As I read this, as a student of history and psychology, I start to think to myself, what does it take for somebody to speak up about something going bad? And I have a video I actually posted years ago where I talked about why I don't discuss politics. I was very proud of myself. I was wrong. And over time, I started to speak up. I saw children being separated. I saw lies about taxes. I saw lines got crossed. And I said to myself, I am the son of immigrants. I went to Stanford on scholarship. I've been financially successful. I've bootstrapped a company. I've served 45,000 plus customers. If I can't speak up, then who can? If I can't speak up, then who can? And so I agree with you. It has been confusing and eye-opening to look at people with a platform who have decided to ignore what's going on. And again, I'm not asking anybody to be as political as I am. You choose your destiny. I'm not going to judge for how much you talk about. But I will say that when, you know, we talk about the elephant in the room. I mean, come on. If you're not going to speak up now, then what's the line that has to be crossed for you to say something?
Well, that's that great expression. I think it's from Hillel, the John Lewis popularized it. It's like, if not me, then who? And if not now, then when? I mean, and these are sort of fundamental questions that I think ultimately, though, go to bring us back to the beginning. They're actually a part of your childhood values, but they're also a part of the rich life. Like, what is the point of being financially successful, of building a brand, a platform, having an audience, if you're not going to use it when things count? That's the conclusion I've come to.
When there are consequences on the line, when it's not so easy. And when I go out and talk about this stuff, there are a lot of people who have been reading me, many of my customers who said, Ramit, I've bought XYZ, but I'm out. And that doesn't feel good to see a great paying customer who I really respect. But I also know that there's a larger picture. And again, if I can't do it, then who can? And what is the point of all this time and money that we work for if you're not going to actually leverage it?
I think that's great. And I'm so glad you did. I'm so glad we connected and I appreciate it. Thanks for going over too.
Anytime. I always love talking to you. Thanks for the invitation. And yeah, I just want to say thanks for being courageous. It really means a lot. And I see it and I read it and I recognize it and I appreciate it.
Well, I would say it's literally the least we could do. You know what I mean? There's like real people doing real courageous things. It's literally the least you can do. That doesn't mean it's meaningless, but it's literally the least you're obligated to do as a human being. All right. Thanks, man. I appreciate it.
Great to talk to you.
Don't forget to subscribe to this podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast app. And if you don't get the Daily Stoic email, go to dailystoic.com/email.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to the Daily Stoic early and ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen early and ad-free with Wondery Plus in Apple Podcasts. Guy Raz's How I Built This is a podcast where each week he talks to the founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn the real stories of how they built them. In each episode, you hear these entrepreneurs really go into their story. And Guy is an incredible interviewer. He doesn't just dance around the surface. He has real questions because he himself is an entrepreneur. He's built this huge show and this huge company. In a recent episode, they talked to the founder of Liquid Death, that crazy water company that's become this billion-dollar brand. Follow the show on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can listen to How I Built This early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. And for a deep dive in daily business content, listen to Wondery Destination for Business podcasts with shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, The Best One Yet, Business Movers, and many more. Wondery means business.